Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here at JM and the AM. Mr. Honlein, good morning.
Good morning, Nachum.
Nice to speak with you. We'll begin, of course, with the events of yesterday, the sad events, the terror-filled events that took many people. Israel is burying victims today. They'll be burying more victims on Sunday. A lot of folks already, by the nature of the way news travels these days, are relatively familiar with the details of yesterday. We'll get certainly into some of them, but I want to start with the source of all this. Normally, it would seem, or normally we see, that terror organizations jump to take credit for these types of attacks. Doesn't it seem like there's a hesitancy this time around to do so?
Definitely. There's a hesitancy, and nobody has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks. In their case, it would be claiming credit. It's been praised by Al-Qaeda. It's been praised by other groups. But the situation in Gaza seems such that no one has yet come forward. They do blame the Palestinian Resistance Council or Committee, which is really an amalgam of different organizations. You know, there was a suicide bomber who exploded near Egyptian soldiers close to the crossing of Gaza, and he was identified, according to the Egyptians, as PRC. But for the overall attacks, you know, they were dressed in Egyptian military uniforms,
right?
Some of them were, and carried no, and some of them were identified, but no group has yet been targeted.
Malcolm, was anything that happened yesterday not coordinated? In other words, if we go through the whole list, and many people I'm sure have already, both on the web and in newspapers, if you go through the whole list of all the attacks yesterday and all the different episodes, was everything connected?
Everything was connected. The number is estimated at 15 to 20 terrorists who crossed through a tunnel, came in from a tunnel underneath the Sinai. You know, the border between Gaza and Eilat is 280 kilometers, the Egyptian border with Israel, and the that's an incredible amount of space of a distance,
right?
That would be, as one of the military people told us last night, it's impossible with a soldier every 3 meters or 4 meters to watch this. They had advance warning. They were prepared. They were on higher alert, anticipating an attack. And, you know, the army was there very quickly. And the terrorists, to show you how your question is so appropriate, after the attack, the initial attack on the bus, the soldiers came, and they had already planted roadside bombs that they exploded, which blew up the car in which some of the soldiers were. At the same, then a short while later was the second attack with a rocket-propelled grenade or missile launched into the car that two couples were in, two sisters and their husbands, and were all killed. And again, the third attack, and then later on there was a fourth attack later in the day. They indicated that seven of the terrorists were killed there, and seven more were killed in strikes against Gaza, including one of those responsible for the Gilad Shalit kidnapping. And the belief is that that was the goal this time, was, again, to kidnap Israelis, both soldiers and civilians, and to take them back through the tunnel into Gaza.
When you say Israel had warning, they've had warning since when?
I can't tell you how many days, but I do know that of late they have had a warning that there was an attack being planned or under consideration.
And so in a certain sense, it didn't take the authorities by complete surprise, but obviously the nature of the attack was, by nature, a complete surprise.
Right, and we don't know how many they prevented. The bus driver, in fact, said when he saw the Egyptians in these military uniforms, as he thought they were, he thought they were fixing the fence, and he even slowed down as he passed by, and then they opened fire on them. The other thing is about coordination is that as the soldiers were arriving on the scene, they fired missiles from Gaza to the site, which added to the carnage there.
And a unique type of missile, or one that hadn't been used in a while, right?
Well, that's the second part of the story, is the increase in the number of rockets. And, in fact, Iron Dome was deployed and took down one of the missiles, which they fire when they're endangering a city like Ashkelon or Beersheba. And both of these fell very close. You know, it's 30 minutes from Tel Aviv. There's been a sharp increase in recent weeks in a number of rockets, and including the firing of a Grad rocket, which is much more advanced. There were six rockets, I think, or eight rockets overnight, and so this is clearly an escalation of on their part. This has been going on for several weeks, and we've reported it here. But and we don't know again how many attacks have been prevented,
mm-hmm.
and the intelligence this time was very good, and the Army stressed it that they were able to track down some of the people, get them. The roads are still blocked down south because they're searching for other terrorists, and Israel has to build, and they are in the process of building, but it has to expedite building a wall between Israel and on the Egyptian border. This is it's really critical. As you know, the Bedouin know how to get through virtually everything in the desert, and they smuggle and they engage in crime and prostitution, drugs, everything else, as well as the thousands of people who cross from Africa across the Sinai and get into Israel. So it's really critical on a lot of grounds for Israel to complete defense.
Asking you to conjecture isn't fair, but we're curious about, if not for the unrest in Egypt, would things have unfolded differently, or there's no reason to suspect so?
Well, that is a good question. The answer is that the unrest certainly contributes today to the lawlessness in the Sinai, the really open season, and as you know, last week, more than 1,000 Egyptians troops moved in. They arrested 20 people who were believed to be responsible for the blowing up of the gas pipeline to Jordan and Israel. Other arrests were made, but Hamas has refused to turn over to Egypt those who attacked the police station, the Egyptian police station, and killed six people. They refused to cooperate on some of the other efforts that the Egyptians have been involved in, because obviously they have a big stake in it, and you have Al-Qaeda, Iran, others. And when I came back from Egypt in March, I told you that this was the issue the generals warned most about, was the conditions in the Sinai, and said that they feared an Islamist state being created. That's still the fear. And I think Hamas takes advantage of the situation, both with the import of weapons, which is almost uncontrolled now, and their willingness to carry out the attacks. It's not the sole reason. There's obviously a motivation, a political motivation,
right.
Others that may be related to the PA, to their struggle with the PA. They put a ban yesterday on students studying abroad, they especially with U.S. scholarships. So they're doing many things which would indicate perhaps some internal pressures as well.
And allow me to revisit the what was really prevalent during the intifadas, the old, terrorism has no address theory. How does Israel know where to attack yesterday? How do they know where to target when they immediately need to retaliate?
Well, they had, there were several attacks, seven attacks, many of them very pinpointed. So good intelligence, and that's one of the reasons why people say, you can't replace it. Everybody says, well, in this age of rockets, it doesn't matter whether you're on the ground and whether you have a physical presence and ability to engage in this kind of intelligence operation. Of course it matters, and it matters a great deal, and especially in such a complex situation. So it was good intelligence.
And the irony that we were discussing last week, the cost, the cost in human life we know, and the stories are just horrifying, but we were talking last week, you'll recall, about the cost for a small country like this to undertake these types of missions, and sure enough, look what happens. Just imagine what Israel went through yesterday in order to accomplish what they needed to accomplish.
When Iron Dome is fired, people always say to me, well, why don't they just deploy more of them? And why don't
right.
they just move one into deployment near Ashkelon overnight? Each time they fire it, it costs $100,000.
Unbelievable.
And take out a missile, or it could be one of these things that they fire, that costs them $35 or $100 to make. So, you're absolutely right. People lose sight about what the cost is. And when the budget, as Israel's, is now under scrutiny and under a lot of pressure. One of the other factors, by the way, in Gaza today is that the Hamas has been put into a real quandary regarding Syria. With the attack on the Palestinian refugee camp in Latakia, there was a more and more pressure on Hamas to come out and condemn the Syrian regime.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, Syria is one of their major backers, and certainly via Iran, via Syria, has been a major backer. And so on one hand, they don't want to alienate their home constituency. On the other hand, they are afraid of alienating Iran, Syria. So it's it puts pressure, and this may be also a diversion for them to show, you know, their true loyalty to the war against the Zionist entity, but at the same time not having to come out against Assad.
What is this going to do now in terms of what might happen at the UN next month? Is this, and by the way, I don't remember who it was. I'm sure you could tell me who, which PA official was it that said that, that Israel's using this as an opportunity to, squelch the possibilities of a Palestinian state, meaning the opportunity to, you know, as Israel attacks Gaza.
Right. Nabil Shat.
That's who it was?
Who said it. And, it will have no impact whatsoever. If you notice, the New York Times and NPR's coverage of this already, where they, the Times refers to the soldiers, even though it was only one soldier killed and the rest were civilians, that these were attacks on civilians and soldiers came to respond to it. The NPR talking about an attack which took seven lives, not four attacks, not coordinated attacks, not the real nature of what took place. So it's very disturbing when you see the nature of the coverage on a thing like this. I mean, this is no less an outrage, let's say, than the attack in Norway mm-hmm. or other attacks against civilians, innocent civilians coming, going on vacation to Eilat or just traveling home. Two children were killed amongst those, and 40 people were injured, which also doesn't get mentioned. So it does not have any direct implication, I think, for the UDI. The UDI campaign is going on. Some Palestinians took a softer line, tougher lines. Fayyad told the members of Congress who were there that he's absolutely opposed. Everybody else is for it. What we can tell you from on the ground, and as you know, I was a skeptic about how far they would go, actually, everything points now that they have a very intense campaign ongoing with all their 130 representatives around the world, that is representatives of the Palestinian Authority, so-called, working around the clock. They have enlisted Arab countries and others to help pressure, and there's evidence that even Russia has been playing a role in some countries, urging them to vote for the unilateral declaration. They may yet go to the General Assembly and to the Security Council and force a U.S. veto, which we believe is solid, but they may also try a softer language in order to get the EU, the European Union, on board. One of the goals they have now is to avoid what is called a moral minority, meaning that many of the European Union countries, others will stay out of it. Each country, though, has its own agenda. Two countries, Australia and Hungary, that would normally be completely supportive of Israel, are not, because they both want seats on the Security Council. And remember that Canada lost the seat because it was seen as too pro-Israel.
Is there any possibility that the United States would cave into pressure and abstain?
I do not believe there is any possibility that the United States would not exercise the veto and will not vote against it in the General Assembly, where there is no veto. And what is important is that they will have an automatic majority. You need two-thirds of those present voting at the General Assembly. The General Assembly cannot declare a country. It can't recognize a country per se. It can, for instance, elevate their status to the equivalence of what the Vatican is, a non-member status.
Right.
They can allow them to become members of specialized agencies, which would give them much broader involvement and influence. It could also become the basis for an approach to the International Criminal Court, which was always Abbas's primary target, to get standing there so that they can sue Israel for war crimes and bring all sorts of charges against Israel. What we believe and what we heard this week, and I can't say that this is confirmed, but it certainly seems to me to be a well-thought-out strategy where they will go first to the General Assembly, get a resolution recognizing them, but it doesn't give them membership in the United Nations. It'll give them, as I said, maybe an elevated status. There are a lot of different options. And then they will go to say Israel has not recognized and enforced this resolution of the General Assembly, so they will go back and ask for sanctions against Israel along the lines of what they did to South Africa. And whether under Uniting for Peace or some other way, try to get the General Assembly to pass sanctions and then come back a third time about the violations and to have some punishment imposed on Israel.
I hope Israel has some moves planned in this chess game.
I have to say the Israel mission to the United Nations has been very active. The Jewish community has been very active. As you know, we encourage people to visit consuls general of all the consulates in New York and around the country. And we have been meeting with ambassadors. I met yesterday with several. And then in September, when the General Assembly convenes, we have meetings with many heads of state and foreign ministers. This is also being done in Europe. It's being done elsewhere to try and counter the campaign of the Palestinians, aided by countries like Venezuela and Iran and others who are putting pressure on countries. And countries don't want to stand out. So in Latin America, for instance, we only have a few who are still with us. Honduras, the president of Honduras, announced in a speech that he was supporting the unilateral declaration, and now they've removed it from their website, although they haven't yet rescinded the position. They've come under a lot of pressure. And there are people who do business in countries in Africa, in Asia, in South America, elsewhere, especially Europe, who can help bring pressure, mm-hmm. can help raise the profile of this issue. We have one person who has really been amazing in approaching the doctor and people who has treated as a president of a country. And that every lead like that, one of them will work ultimately. So yeah. It's very important. The implications of this as a propaganda victory, aside from whatever tangible implications down the road there could be in terms of the Palestinians' ability to cause mischief and harass Israel, the propaganda value, how this will be seen, is also important.
You can give plenty of examples in Jewish history.
And when people see their congressmen who are home now on vacation or traveling but will be in the districts now, it's a time to call them, meet with them, and tell them we expect them to implement the resolution passed by 406-6. I think the New York delegation will be solidly on it, but they should hear from it. They need to be reinforced that the United States will cut off the aid. You know, the Arabs gave $500 million in 2009 and half of that in 2010. This year they gave them $79 million. The United States is giving $600 million plus, and half of the budget of the Palestinian Authority is foreign aid. And so if the United States leads the way on this, I think that even some Europeans and others might be willing to join, though less likely. There is no unity in the European Union right now, and they are trying to develop a consensus and so have been working on alternative language for a resolution that might gain broader support. But from what we can see, it's not likely. There are countries, Italy, Czech Republic, others who have come out against it. Germany is against it. France, we have learned, has been lobbying for it. And that is certainly disturbing.
Back to your prior point, you could find plenty of times in Jewish history where personal relationships have changed Jewish history. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmam.org. We are talking about the events of the week, dominated by the sad events of the week in Israel, as the enemy has reared its ugly head again in direct fashion against Israeli civilians. As you heard Malcolm emphasize, this was an attack on Israeli civilians, soldiers who were killed or injured. That was a targeted attack on those who would come in the aftermath of the initial attack by the enemy. I didn't give you a chance to talk about Israeli response politically or diplomatically. We spoke about militarily. How did the prime minister do yesterday in the wake of this attack?
Well, I think he did very well. I think the military did well. I think there will be a lot of questions asked that if they had all these warnings, why more couldn't have been done or should have been done. But, you know, it's always easy to second guess or in hindsight to assess what could have happened. You know, they have to be on alert 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because there are constant attempts to penetrate. And by the way, Abbas told a group of visiting congressmen yesterday that he will not allow any Jewish settlers or settlements in the Palestinian Authority, which many of them, you know, were quite aghast at that declaration, meaning that you're going to take 500,000 Jews out. And yet, you don't see the condemnation. The quartet met to condemn Israel because of a few lousy apartments, and whether the timing is good, not good. This is only about the planning. Even in their condemnation, they said to advance the planning process. They know that there's no construction going on. This is only, and all of this is within the existing land. This is not expanding any settlements in Ariel. It's being done in the center of Ariel. So this was a principle that the Bush administration accepted, that you build up and in, not out. And as long as you don't change the footprint, they said, look, we know Ariel, by consensus, is going to remain within Israel, even after a deal. So why is it that they can come together and condemn, be so quick to have unanimity on about these apartments, and then condemn the unilateral actions as if the Declaration of Independence is equivalent to building a few apartments? And the implications of this, again, is, you mean we see this incredible hypocritical standard that is applied, and the, you know, it's just sometimes it becomes more and more mind-boggling as you see it in the light of this attack. So a number of countries did condemn the terrorist attack yesterday. You don't see the kind of chorus of outrage. Israel did go to the talk about having a session of the Security Council and certainly lodged a complaint. I know they met yesterday with the Secretary General.
You mentioned members of Congress with you know, visiting the PA. I read somewhere this is the largest delegation ever in a summer from the United States Congress to visit Israel.
It's not one delegation; it's three. There are two Republican and one.
No, meaning the largest delegation. Number of members of Congress to go in one
right.
period of time.
It is the largest number, and these are mostly freshman congressmen to have gone in one summer. Every year there are such visits, and you have scores of members going. But because of the turnover, you had many more who had not been to Israel before, and therefore took advantage of the opportunity. And it's, as you know, there's nothing that sells Israel better than a visit to Israel, and why we have the America's Voices program. And I have to say that, you know, we've started bringing Hollywood stars, we're bringing other people that everybody told me wouldn't go, they don't want to be associated with Israel, and we don't have enough space for everybody who wants to go. And that includes, we're now doing sports stars and Hispanic leaders and evangelical leaders. And by the way, the PA is doing this also. The Palestinians are replicating it and including going after the evangelical community. And we are bringing Christian ministers and others of mega churches to Israel. And we are finding a lot of receptivity. There are some who are afraid to go. You know, they all have the image of Israel is always, you know, just on the verge of falling into the ocean. But there is a much more receptivity to it. And these members of Congress, when they come back, you know, I spoke to several who were there, including one who is there now, and, you know, they just said it's an eye-opener when you see it. And then they meet the Palestinians, and he can make this kind of statement of ethnic cleansing, and yet there's no condemnation.
Yeah, and in front of members of the U.S. Congress on top of that. By the way, I heard someone mention that of all the candidates for president, Rick Perry has visited Israel more than any other. Have you seen that statistic?
Yeah, he's been there very often, and he has always spoken out on Israel.
Are you enjoying watching many people get flustered and all upset about his candidacy?
No, I don't enjoy it because, you know, I think the stakes are so high in this election, I think. And remember, it's a year away. What scares me is people are just going to get so sick and tired of all the election, all the campaigning, everybody. Both Democrats and Republicans.
Oh, they're sick already.
Well, they're sick. Yeah,
no, people hate this stuff.
And yeah, but we have a whole year more of it before you come to the election, more than a year, 14 months. And this is not a time when people can get tired or disengage or, God forbid, not vote or not care. We have to go through the system. It's a healthy system to have people involved and expose candidates. You know, this year it's only on one side because you don't have a contestation on the Democratic side, but you have a lot of important congressional races, senatorial races. The amounts of money that are being raised in every community, including ours, is mind-boggling and will continue to be so, and it drains a lot of money out of that might otherwise go to other charitable or other things. But it is an appropriate thing that people should care and should, you know, support the candidates that they favor.
But my point more specifically, there are members of the Jewish media who are in a panic over Perry's popularity.
Yeah, right. And they don't panic so much, you know, on all parts of the spectrum when candidates emerge or, you know, the way they treat Gumbeck. You know, Gumbeck says sometimes offensive things. Sometimes these guys shoot from the lips. People make mistakes. But people make mistakes even if they're in office, even if they are experienced, even if Joe Biden, look at all the things that he said, or other people. And They don't get equal treatment. I think they should be scrutinized, and where there are things of concern, they should be pointed out, and they should be criticized. And when people apologize, and if it's sincere, we move on. But you evaluate the totality of the candidate. This apoplectic approach doesn't seem to me to be valid.
All right, now to the headline that was the headline for this conversation until the enemy decided to alter things yesterday. So is the United States, in fact, demanding that Assad leave Syria?
They are demanding it, and they are talking about a sanction regime. But the question is, why did it take so long? Where is how much support they will really get in the long term? You have a number of important points this week that emerge in regard to Syria, aside from the escalation of the violence. What appears to be clear is that Assad is trying to play on sectarian hatred. In Latakia, where they went after the Palestinians and after the Sunnis, you have 1 million Alawites living there. So it's clear that he wants to cleanse it and leave the Alawites there, and perhaps if he falls, that they will be able to protect themselves, not having to face perhaps violence from their neighbors or retribution, which is a big concern that the Alawite population will face very severe consequences if Assad falls, and something that Assad said to me when I met him back in the beginning of the year. So that's one. We see an escalation in many places of sectarian violence, and he plays sectors against one another, and therefore it's, you know, divide and conquer. Big development, Turkey. Turkey coming out more publicly, demanding change on the part of Assad, at one point saying he had 15 days to do it, so the Syrians were all demonstrating, the opposition, and it says 15 days equals 450 dead. What are you waiting for? So the Turks have not earned much praise from the Sunni population or others in Syria because they were helping him, and the border is still a very hot area, and whether Turkey will feel necessary to put troops there or do other things is unclear. And right now they're targeting the Kurds. They bombed the Kurds, and yet the international community doesn't seem to care that Turkey can do all this while it condemns Israel for defending itself and supported the flotilla at a time.
How many people is he responsible for killing in this action, Assad, at the last few weeks?
Thousands. Nobody knows the real numbers. I get every day a body count from Syrian opposition sources, but there are thousands who are missing. So it's very hard to know, in Hama and other places, and they're, because they're cut off from reporters and you don't really know what the real numbers are.
Does it matter one way or the other from his perspective that the U.S. wants him out?
Well, the sanctions could hurt him further, but I would say right now it's not going to be the major thing. They look at Gaddafi, even though there's talk about Gaddafi being offered asylum and that he might leave to go to Venezuela or someplace. It's reported that Spain offered Assad asylum for him and his family, and he turned it down. One of the things he said is, as I said, it's not just him. It's going to be the Alawites, who are 10% of the population in Syria, so he's afraid of that. And you don't have a united opposition. You don't have centralized leadership that people, especially the business community, feel comfortable going against Assad when they don't see that there's a system like the Egyptian army offered an alternative, a unifying national force. You don't have that in Syria, and the likelihood is it would break down and you would have ethnic and tribal violence and many other things. But anyway, so the report was that Spain had offered asylum. He rejected it. Tunisia and others are breaking diplomatic relations. The more isolated he becomes, he can go two ways. One is to become more assertive, or two, maybe at some point get the message. He won't, as long as Iran is continuing to back him. And what if you saw this week, Iraq, the prime minister of Iraq, supported Assad because of pressure from Iran. So Iran is replacing Turkey in the coalition that he had with Syria, Hezbollah, and Gaza. He now has Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza. That's Ahmadinejad. So, and we know that there's reports from a general who defected that Iranian snipers are shooting in a lot of the cities, and Iran's direct involvement in both in weapons but also in manpower, Hezbollah involvement, despite their denials.
We see, and you've predicted what the unrest in Egypt would do regarding the Israeli Egyptian border. We certainly have seen what's gone on up in Lebanon the last few years. He's ousted in Syria. Does the same type of situation arise between Israel and Syria on that border?
It's a good question. Nobody knows. And what he has threatened, and I've gotten messages from various people and sources that, you know, Assad is saying he's going to carry out an ultimate weapon, even a nuclear weapon. And I said, how do you know he has one? And they said, oh, no, he gets it from Iran, or he has other abilities, but that he would do something very drastic and dramatic if he would see that he was falling. I'm not sure about that. I would doubt it. I think these, first of all, Israel is well prepared. They've reinforced the border with Syria, and Syria knows the consequences of such an attack. But, you know, somebody in a state of desperation can often do even irrational things.
Why does it seem to the casual observer, or at least in my case, that that border is in fact more secure than what Israel can do to secure Lebanon and the future Egyptian border?
Well, the Egyptian border is so long, and the conditions are such that it's a much harder border. The Syrian border is a very difficult one. You know, if you, as I'm sure you have, you know, you come there and it's a mountainous region. Hezbollah, you can see the Hezbollah encampments. You see them walking around in buildings without any windows, and they say, just look there, and then all of a sudden you see the flash of a guy walking by. Hamas is there within, it's a short distance between some of the major encampments all along Israel's northern border.
So the potential is just as drastic as anywhere else.
Yeah, God, in Lebanon, you know, actually the Lebanese forces and others have been acting to try and keep that border quiet. Right now, the situation in Lebanon is quite tense because, as you know, the UN court, the special tribunal that was investigating the murder of their former prime minister, Hariri, has named the four Hezbollah agents and now, this week, released the evidence against them. This was the result of a six-year investigation. Of course, Hezbollah will not turn them over and rejects it and blames it on a Zionist plot and America's plot. And by the way...
And what was the difference now? The difference now is that the report is official?
But they released the evidence. And also, there are reports that they are now looking to the Iranian connection. And, of course, Hezbollah is apoplectic about this report, rejecting it. But I think they found that you can release the report, and it didn't have the consequences that they were afraid of. Two other things in that regard, you know, that Syria, Assad, continues to say that the demonstrations are the result of U.S. and Israeli influence. The Egyptian generals this week blamed the pro-democracy demonstrators as being tools of the United States. These are our friends to whom we're giving billions of dollars in aid. The generals came out now and talked about American NGOs and et cetera, and they arrested, as you know, an Israeli-American who they charged and will put on trial, as well as a Jordanian. I think it's... This guy was certainly, I think, not a spy. And we'll have to see what happens in the court. And he comes actually from the New York area. His parents live in the New York area. I think it's a very dangerous situation. And if they look for scapegoats, you know, you can always find them. But the very fact that the generals are also adopting this line, and we see closer alliance between them and the Muslim Brotherhood and even the Salafis, is of great concern.
Anybody learn a lesson from yesterday on the side of the enemy, meaning that, the fact that now it's known that Israel was aware that there was going to be an attack, that they did respond as quickly as they did. Does any of this help in terms of trying to quell future attacks, or essentially the enemy ignores what type of response Israel issues forth?
They don't care how many people get killed. They care about their own leadership, and when Israel targets their leadership to international condemnation... the United States is doing it with drones in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and it's okay. But when Israel did it, as you remember, they were condemned each time.
Right.
But our enemy doesn't care. They don't value human life, not of the enemy and not of their own. They are driven by extremist goals, and whatever at that moment suits their purposes.
So nothing that happened yesterday.
It could be internal political divisions. It could be other things. So they will never learn a lesson. They cool it off for a little while. Hamas can say, you know, we're trying to restrain them. It's not us, it's them, in order to avoid the retribution. But ultimately, they don't care how many people die as long as they achieve their goal, which is the destruction of Israel.
I asked this question last week. So with all that in mind, is it possible, God forbid, that there's another stage to the Intifada coming, that the enemy is going to step things up, so to speak?
Well, that's one of the concerns about this gambit on the part of Abbas to have the unilateral declaration, because the day afterwards, what is he going to tell his people that he gained? What did he achieve? It'll be a cutoff of U.S. aid, I hope, and other sanctions, perhaps. So what will he have gained? Israel will engage in some sanctions. There are people saying that if they do it, Israel should annex the West Bank. So other people had other schemes. I think we won't move that quickly in that direction, but there could be serious things. Israel could withhold the tax that they pass on to the Palestinian Authority and the assistance that that they render. So there are a lot of possible ramifications, but one of them is that people become so frustrated and saying, you know, this was all a dead end, and you can have eruptions. Right now, the demonstrations that have been threatened, and they're talking about the day of the UDI in various places, right now they're targeting those demonstrations to be inside the cities because they don't want a confrontation with Israeli forces. There are those who are threatening that they will march en masse to Israeli settlements or communities in the West Bank, or that they will actually march on the border, all of which would present Israel with terrible dilemmas and situations. But an intifada, I think right now the Palestinian people, there's no indication that they want it. But you never know what can trigger acts of violence, even limited, that get out of hand.
All right, we have Rabbi Yudanon from Israel.
One important news that U.S. Marines, a big contingent, are now training in Israel on urban warfare together with Israelis. And the leader of the Marines said yesterday, he said, Israel is just like the U.S. He said, being here, we better understand what really Israel is really about and appreciate it, and we will go home and tell everyone.
Malcolm really tried to encourage Aliyah. Israel is just like the U.S.
Well, this is this non-Jewish Marine general telling about the impression. So even when we look at, you know, all the tensions to see how the level of cooperation, especially in the military area, of Israel's importance, that how Israel continues to progress, and with the demonstrations, with everything else, that Israel is secure and safe and people should not hesitate to visit. The opposite, now's the time to visit and go to Eilat, even spend one day there to show solidarity.
Yeah, oh, Eilat's the best, let me tell you. Loved our visit to Eilat. As you daven in your fancy shul tomorrow here in outside of Israel, remember the future of the Jewish peoples in the state of Israel. You daven in a fancy shul or not?
No.
You
but,
do not.
But remember, we face it to Yerushalayim, so
true.
We always remember.
Thank God at the minimum we do that. Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Helmlein is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. I'm back next Thursday and Friday, so we'll do the weekly update again 1 week from today.